The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Heretics 2-Hour tonight. Coming live from the White Network. It's September 9th, 2013. I'm watching my... You know, I start out real low. You can hardly hear me. And even though I'm trying to warm up my mic before I get started, I guess I don't get it warmed up enough. And it takes quite a bit of warming up to get this mic to start going at the level that it should be at. Looks like it's still not doing very well. But anyway, as I said, it's September 9th, 2013. The year is flying by. It looks like there's a break in the war drums against Syria by the Jews. Let's hope so. But it is true that our lives are dominated by Jewish interests, Jewish plans and goals, Jewish personalities, and Jewish ideas. So tonight I'm going to talk about various aspects of that. And I'm going to start out with the new post that I have put up at Elie Wiesel Cons the World, my website about Elie Wiesel. And I have, this post is more about Ken Walzer, because I've turned my attention quite a bit to Ken Walzer, because, he is the one who is showing us that, all of the information that he has written in the past and that he has promised for the future, which includes Elie Wiesel at Buchenwald, because he's right, his specialty has become the children who were kept at Buchenwald in the children's barracks. And Elie Wiesel was one of them, supposedly. And he insists that he was there and he's got proof and so on. But whenever it's challenged, and I've been the one that's been challenging him, it is not, we don't find that he promises that he's coming up with all this stuff, but he never publishes it. So, therefore, I wanted to bring up, I started looking up information, if there's any new information about him on Saturday night, and to see if I could find, you know, something that I could write about. Because I'm not writing on Elie Wiesel blog very often because, I'm so busy with other things, but there's nothing that seems real necessary. And I want to keep pushing on this Elie Wiesel is not at Buchenwald theme. But there's not much about Elie Wiesel to write about either. So, but I discovered that he had put together this exhibition about Michigan Jews. Ken Walzer had, and Ken Walzer now is a full professor at Michigan State University. He's been there a long time. He's head of their Jewish Studies program, as well as supposedly teaching some history classes. Now, you know, he has a PhD. In history from Harvard University. And he is the worst historian. He's never done any decent historian type work that I know of. And I don't know, he's employed by the Jewish lobby or the Israel, the international jury, whatever part of it he might be, probably all of it, to help promote Jews. And so, you know, he got his education and probably he's helped with that. And he got into Harvard. He's, you know, he got graduated from Harvard, got his PhD, got into, you know, I don't know if his MSU was his first university, but he's been there for a long time. So it's close to being the first, if it wasn't the first that he ever went to. And he's in like Flynn there, you know, because the Jewish media makes sure that, well, in the past it did, that he was seen as an expert and he was, you know, written about and asked about things when they came up. And, you know, he was looked upon, gave him all a very positive image. So people, then he was just seen as an expert on Holocaust. And he's been... he's focused on this children at Buchenwald, the children who were protected in that barracks at Buchenwald. That he insists, his story is that they are protected by these communist prisoners rather than that they were simply taken care of by the German camp authorities, which they were, you know. But no, they have to come up with a different story that somehow the camp authorities forgot all about these kids. And these kids had been sort of hidden away in this place, and they were looked after by these communist prisoners. And the reason that they survived and that they were still healthy and all that was because of the efforts of these communists, which were just a few of them, a handful, and mostly two of them have the biggest reputation there. But, you know, it's all a bunch of hogwash. And I have been trying to say that Kenneth Walser is just full of hogwash. And now he won't even answer. He used to respond to things. And that's when he made a lot of his promises. But now he doesn't even answer. And I'll get into a little bit more of that in a minute. But right now I want to go back to my talk about this Elie Wiesel new article up just a little bit. Because as I got, as I found that exhibition that he had put on, I thought, well, see, you know, maybe I can write about this. And as I looked at it, I was just kind of dumbfounded, but also I thought, oh, this is really good, you know, because here's this thing all about Jews, just from Michigan, from a certain period of time, so that, you know, these Jews can take any little time period and find Jews somewhere and then make a big deal out of them, you know, talk about them and make a whole lot out of it. So that's what they've done. That's what Walter has done here. This exhibit, he got MSU, Michigan State University, to sponsor this. You know, as I wrote in this blog here, that university academics have to keep writing, you know, producing something in their field to show that they're actively engaged in it and so on. You can't just get your professorship and then just sit back and teach your students. That's not, you know, you have to continue to publish and be active. And he's supposed to be working on this book, you see, which he now titles, let's see, oh gosh, I'll find it down here, Telling the Story. He's added to his working title. And it's now, he says, Telling the Story, The Rescue of Children at Buchenwald. It started out kind of being called The Boys of Buchenwald and variations on that, but he dropped that idea, The Boys of Buchenwald, and he's got it this way. So he's got a story to tell, and he's been working on this for quite a few years, and this was his major project, and he had a few little sideline things that he did. He gave talks about it, you know, his progress so far, and he gave seminars and so on. Always this came up. This was his theme. And then he produced some videos, and then somebody else made a big video a couple years ago, and he was an advisor on it, so he gets a lot of credit for that. And as I said, then he, what's he doing now? Well, now he's got this exhibition I discovered that, you know, for about Jews in Michigan. And this is supposed to, I guess, since it's a Michigan State University project, this is something that, you know, makes it, that he, you know, gets credit for. He's being active in his field. While he still says he's got his book almost ready to come out. Now, like 3 or 4 years ago, he said his book would be out in a year. And he just keeps saying that, my book is be out in a year. We're still waiting, but I've got what I say about that. This is not really the topic of my show tonight, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But I do, maybe I'll just point out right here, since I'm talking about his book, that in the title, Telling the Story, that he writes, and I put this in a footnote on the article there on the Elie Wiesel tattoo website. My own book, Telling the Story, will be finished in about a year. He said this in a question and answer session in 2011-2012. So that's, we're like now 2013-2014. It's September already. So, so that's like 2 years ago. And he said it'd be out in a year. Now he's still not saying when it's going to be out, but, and he says that he's going to give a lot of detail and, you know, he's going to tell the story drawing on information obtained from nearly 200 of these survivors in Nazi camps. And somehow from their stories, he's going to put together what happened at Buchenwald and put together these children's stories. Well, I think that, you know, he keeps sort of expanding his, what's going to be included, because he's trying to get away from having to prove that certain people were there and did and what happened to him, did what happens is what he says happened, what they say happened, because he says, you know, it's all about their story. And as I say here, that he's talking to old men about what happened to them when they were children, and they're telling him, and this is what he is putting down as history. History, because history is really a story, you know, that the historian puts together from whatever he can find. But he's, since Ken Walzer is not an honest man, he's not an honest person. He's in the employee of the Jewish government, I'd say, the Jewish World Endeavor. He's one of them, and he does what's necessary. So he's putting this, he says whatever he wants to say. So he gets away from, okay, another thing I want to say here is that he admittedly relies on survivor testimony. He doesn't use anything else anymore. And he's given talks and so on about how valuable survivor testimony is and how they don't, you know, because that's what he's left with. That's all he's got. And he can't use anything else. Now, he's defended these documents at Buchenwald about this Lazar Wiesel and Abraham Wiesel. And he's defending them as being documents that belong to refer to Elie Wiesel and his father Shlomo. But now he probably wants to stay away from that. I'm very anxious to get him to open up and say something. Very anxious for this book to come out, because I will go after it for sure. And I want to tell you that that the last I heard from him, and I mentioned this on a show before, he sent me an email. You know, he used to respond once in a while, and he would even respond in the comments on forums. And he got into so much trouble, and nobody believes him now. People are making fun of him. So at least our people are. So he has stopped doing that. And the last I heard from him was on March 28, 2013, after I did a program, that last program about him, where I used a picture on the program page, a picture of him, and he wrote me an email, and he said, "Please remove my picture from your website and stop issuing lies about me. You are ridiculous. My websites at UM Flint are down because I was appointed there 1 year, and I'm now back at Michigan State. You had nothing to do with it." Now, see, that's not the reason that his website was down. He never went back up again. He's back at Michigan State, but his website never went back up again. And he's got something totally different with very little information on it, and not all this stuff about Elie Wiesel either. So he's lying there. But then he goes on to say to me, "The book is on track, and I have also completed a separate essay to be published on Elie Wiesel and Buchenwald. Your anti-Semitic campaign against international Jewry, your Holocaust denial, your general ridiculousness are there for all to see. You're a Nazi, plain and simple." Huh, that was it. See, I was nice enough not to repeat that on the air when I mentioned it. I left a lot of that out because I thought, well, it's a private email, but it's not really all that private, is it? And so I didn't know about saying everything that he said. But that was the totality of it. And I will, as particularly after I finish tonight's show, I cannot deny what he's saying there, that I do have a campaign, just like he has a campaign, just like the Jews have a campaign against what's near and dear to me. I have a campaign, too, against them, and I would have to probably agree to being a Nazi if I, after what I'm going to say this evening. So, but it depends on, you know, if the difference is how you look upon these things. And he looks upon Judaism and Jewishness and the international Jewry as a good thing, you know, and the Jews as a wonderful people and who've been persecuted. And I don't, and I know that now that my people have been and are still being persecuted. So the first point I want to make here is that what from this, okay, now from this exhibition, and I've gone to the exhibition page now, and I can't cover it all, but if you've looked at it, and I've got all the links on this article at Elie Wiesel Kahn's World, so you can just click on the links, it'll take you there. And, you know, it's called Uneasy Years, Michigan Jewry During Depression and War. And what strikes me is that you've got, I think I looked up, it was 87,000 Jews in something like that in Michigan. It was in 2012, just last year. Out of however many, I had the number, but, you know, several million, quite a few million people in Michigan. I mean, Michigan's a pretty populous state, not the most populous, but so that's a good number of Jews, but it's not that much. They were like 0.8% of the population. 0.8%, if that would be it. 0.8%, not quite 1% of the population of Michigan are Jews, but that's enough for them to for Ken Walzer to get his university, Michigan State University, to help sponsor this exhibition on Jews in Michigan that he thought would be important and something that would be good for the university to do. It says it's a joint project of the Michigan State University Exhibit Museum and Jewish Studies Program at Michigan State University, with which Ken Walzer heads, and this congregation Sharev Zedek in Lansing. And I've seen their name on a whole lot of these things that are in this exhibition, a lot of material and so on. So, and elsewhere too. So they are a very active Jewish group. And there are a few others, but I guess here it just says these, so these are the main ones. And the faculty leaders and curators are Kenneth Walzer and Kirsten Firmiglich. And some of the other MSU people there connected with Ken are also Jewish, and they're mentioned somewhere. But they just got all the Jews to donate everything they had in the way of photographs and memorabilia and things from World War II, you know, flyers and posters and whatever, and all this stuff that would show that what the Jews were going through. And the whole theme of it is that Jews were suffering from anti-Semitism. There was a big, big problem, anti-Semitism, in the 30s, and not so much in the 40s, but, you know, as the rise of Adolf Hitler in Europe was somehow affecting these Jews in Michigan. You don't see any actual evidence that they are affected by that, except that they were trying to get America to go to war to save the Jews, and they were trying to help supply food and help and money and so on to the Jews of Europe. And what you notice through all of this is that all of these Jews are only interested in helping Jews. And it's very clear when this whole exhibit makes it very, very clear that all they're interested in doing is supporting Jews and Jewish interests, and they go along with every bit of it. So Well, I think this helps to show us this article there, and which goes over this exhibit that Walter has put together, is just another way of seeing how Jews are entangled into American society in every way. You know, since there's a link there to a Jewish virtual page showing how many Jews are in every state of the Union and how they've grown from in the American Union from 1890 something to 2012. And so it's just amazing, you know, when this huge Jewish wave came around 1900 and after that, the Jewish population of the United States grew, and most of them were Russian and Polish from Eastern Europe. A lot of the German Jews had come earlier than that, although there were German Jews still coming, German Jews that had been living in Eastern Europe. And there were Germans, too. I mean, there were just regular Germans. But So the Jewish population in the United States grew greatly, and they have managed to entangle themselves into American society at every level, in every aspect, in every possible way you can, where you wouldn't even expect them, you know, to be, but there they are. And this exhibit that he's put together that I've written about is a good way of seeing how that happened, seeing how that plays out, I'll say, in one little area like the state of Michigan. Now, when we think about Jews being entangled in American society, we have, we can think right away of the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, started in 1913, that now tells police departments and sheriff's departments what to do. It has this almost quasi governmental authority about it, and it lays down the law about a lot of things, and it involves itself also in schools, and it sends teaching materials to schools to teach them about Jews and the and Judaism, and also about the Holocaust big time. And there are a lot of Jewish organizations that put together these Holocaust teaching packages and send them to schools. And they're all, oh, yeah, this is good. I mean, they're all accepted. They wouldn't dare say we don't want this stuff, because they've passed these laws, too, that we have to teach the Holocaust in schools. And they've passed all these laws that make it impossible to not follow what the Jews want in every aspect of our lives. And the SPLC is also, you know, Jewish and referred to on all issues concerning minorities, etc. But there are all kinds of other organizations. I mean, we have an overload of Jews on the Supreme Court, on all the courts, in all of our government areas, in the universities. It was talking about this well-known how Harvard has become basically a Jewish University, and a lot of others are also Boston University. A lot of them are just highly, highly Jewish. And I was looking at, I looked up for Michigan State University, the president, right before the show. So I wanted to see if it was a Jew, because I just got that idea. Gee, I wonder if the president, because Ken Walser seems to get away with all kinds of stuff there, and he's seems to be very popular and well-liked. He can do what he wants. And so I thought, who is in charge of this school? And the current president is Lou Anna Kimsey Simon. So right off, I thought, oh, Simon. But as I looked further, it looks like her maiden name is Kimsey. Her husband is Roy Simon. But I think I didn't have time to look into Roy Simon, and he might not have anything on him. But that is the Jewish name, Simon. So she might be married to a Jew, and who knows, Kimsey might even be a Jewish name. She was kind of dykey looking, sort of like that latest Supreme Court justice, that woman. Can't think of her name right now, but, you know, she kind of, she didn't look like her, but, you know, kind of along those lines. So they're, you know, they're very, very powerful in all the academic areas, too. And they Jews publicize themselves, like in this exhibition. They show extreme pride in themselves and in every accomplishment. And you see that in this exhibition. You know, whatever they have done from large to tiny is just wonderful. And they point it out and they, you know, puff up their chests. And they can write and talk about themselves endlessly. They never lose interest in themselves. So they're always promoting themselves. And no one else seems to have the ability to do that anywhere close to the way the Jews do it. And they can put, so that's why they can put on something like this exhibit without batting an eye. You know, what, how many of us would think of, let's see if we can organize, because we don't have the contacts and the networking that Walter has. But how would we think? Well, let's see, I think there should be an exhibit for my state about the accomplishments of my people, or how things affected them, or how history affected them. Because the thing is, the Jews have this thing about persecution, and they can always pull that out, and they can always somehow convince you that there's a lot of anti-Semitism around, and that this is something that everybody needs to know about. It's something important. Well, there is a lot of anti-Semitism around, and for good reason. And all we can say is, rather than defend that and say, oh, no, we're not anti-Semitic, the best thing to do to deal with this problem that we have is to come right out and say, yes, we are, and say why. We need to quit hiding from this stuff if we're going to do anything about the power that these Jews have gotten. I talked about the sponsors of this exhibit. I talked about the president. So we're portrayed in America as more and more as really a Jewish nation. We really are. I mean, when you talk about who's, you know, who are the movers and shakers, who are the people that are making the biggest impression and getting things done their way, it's Jews. It's Jews. And we have the feeling we couldn't get along without Jews. And many, many Americans who aren't Jewish, because there are not that many Jews, you know, who are in actual numbers. It seems like it because they're so influential, but there aren't that many in actual numbers that really believe, because of this kind of propaganda that's been going on for so long that I'm talking about, they actually believe that we can't get along without the Jews. And I'll say that, so we're in a situation with too much Jews. Too much Jews. That's what I titled this. We've got too much Jews in our life, in our world, in our environment. That's it. And we need to change that. But many good pro-white writers state the situation that there's too many Jews. A bunch of them do. They talk about it a lot, and what the Jews are doing, and how these Jews are, you know, getting control of this and that. But they never say what to do about it. Nobody comes up with any solutions, because they're afraid to. You know, I don't think any does. I don't know if somebody comes up with solutions. Please let me know. Tell me. Because I don't know any that actually come up with the solution. Because the solutions are too obviously that you have to get rid of them. So I'm going to now jump a little bit to Adolf Hitler and say that Adolf Hitler is the solution. Adolf Hitler is the only person that came up with the solution. Adolf Hitler and his associates and co-workers and so on, and his party, and they came up with the solution. And there is no one else since then who's ever shown up about it. The Jews got rid of the solution. They got rid of Adolf Hitler. They got rid of the Third Reich. And they tell us that we cannot bring forth that solution again. That's out of the question. And people have accepted that because of the total victory of the United States, of the Allies, but especially the United States. The United States was really the main big shot at the end of the war. It was calling the shots. And, of course, there was a division then with the Soviet Union and the West, so that was that was something, but I'm not going to get into that. But, you know, there's nobody since then has shown up with a solution, because that is the only solution there is. And now George Lincoln Rockwell and William Pierce came along. They were made a big splash and did a lot of good. They were both National Socialists. You know, they didn't particularly, only William Pierce didn't want to make too much out of that, but he was. I mean, it was there, and there was no question about it. There has not ever been a better solution, you know, anything. I'm just trying to say that, and I'm going to get off of this, that there has never been anything that has come along since then. So I would say the leader, the white leader that is, the best white leader is still Adolf Hitler, because the others have just been followers of him, other leaders, and so there's no, you know, that really is our solution. So I'll stop on that right now. I want to talk a little bit about Rosius Misch and his death at the age of 96, which was I mentioned on Saturday, and had just a few days before. was he the last Nazi standing? You know, here was a man who was close to Adolf Hitler, who lived, with him from 1940 to 1945, was his personal bodyguard and did other chores, you know, particularly he was the telephone operator and telephone answerer and so on, and message taker and so on. It's said that I'm not sure there aren't some others, but none that are really famous that were, you know, as important to the, you know, as close to what was going on as he was, that is still alive, and now he's gone. Some of the things that he said were that Hitler was no brute, he was no monster, he was no Superman. I think that was good, because he wanted to point out that he was much more of an ordinary man than we want to think. Some of us want to make him into a kind of a god, and then others on the other side, the Jews and so on, and the commie types, want to make him into some kind of a devil, you know, larger than life, though, you know, not. But he was just a man. And somebody who I've been corresponding with a little bit lately wrote this, and I thought it was very good. He said Adolf Hitler's greatness was that he was not a Napoleon. He was a down-to-earth person wrestling with the commonest down-to-earth day-to-day problems of ordinary people. I agree with that. And I've been saying things along those lines for a while, that I don't think we should turn Hitler into one of these Atavars or something, you know, at this point. Anyway, I think, or into our religious symbol or something. I think we need to see him as he is. And we need to see this reality and stop being affected by all that charismatic type of propaganda, where you try to, you know, build things up beyond what they were. So to go on, the story in the newspaper, you know, well, I won't even bother saying that. We know how they try to create negative impressions of these people. But another thing that Misch said was he knew nothing of the murder of 6 million Jews, and that Hitler never brought up the subject of any final solution in his presence. So many others said that. So many who were on trials, in the trials after the war, they said they didn't know anything about these murders. Some of them finally were talked into, tortured into, saying they did know and they heard this and they made up stories and so on to satisfy their prosecutors. And but most of them didn't. And so Mish's just saying that that was never a topic. You know, I read quite a few books of these people that were close to Hitler, but I never read his book. I don't have it. So I'm just going by the newspaper stories. He was able to, he laughed about a family friend he called a real lefty, being thrown into the Sachsenhausen concentration camp outside Berlin, and noting upon his release that the paper shirts at the camp were uncomfortable. But see, he thought things like that were, he still could laugh about things like that, because it was like, you know, Sachsenhausen was no death camp. It was no threat of death by when you're put into a concentration camp. And there's no threat that you're going to be starved to death, that you're going to die, and all that nonsense they come up with. It was so often, the same with Dachau, they put people in there for a while as a kind of a, just like you'd put somebody in jail if they commit some kind of a crime or offense, and you give them a jail term, it might only be a few months, you know. It might be overnight. It might be some. So they used these camps that way. They'd put these political enemies, you know, into the camp, but they always let them out again, for the most part, in not too long of a time. And this fellow was released. And then says that Mish was orphaned at an early age, and he was troubled with the popularity of the Communist Party in Germany, and he decided at the age of 20 to join the SS as a counterweight to the threat from the left. And this is what so many people thought at the time. It really was a viable threat that people were worried about. And he says, I signed up in the war against Bolshevism, not for Adolf Hitler. And he says that, and then he's in this, he was put in the, I didn't say that, but he was put in the Adolf Hitler Liebstandarte SS, Adolf Hitler, and that his that SS division that he was in was attached to a regular army unit for the Blitzkrieg attack on Poland, and so he was there in Poland, and he spoke some Polish because where he was born in Silesia. There was, you know, today's Poland, there was there were Poles there too. And at the time, the Poles were, he was born in 1917. So after the war, the Poles were in charge of that area again, and the Germans were better off if they learned some Polish to get along with the government and everything. So he knew some Polish from living there, growing up there. And so he was sent with this party to negotiate the surrender of a fortress in Poland. And they told the Germans that they needed time to think about it. So the Germans were walking away, feeling that they were dealing with honorable people. And these Poles opened fire on them, as you know, on their backs. And he got a bullet through his chest, and he said it was 2 centimeters from his heart. So this, he had some convalescence back in Germany, and after that, in May 1940, he was appointed by his commanders to become one of Hitler's bodyguards, since he was an SS man and was now not in as good a shape as he had been, I guess, after that wound. So that's when that started, and he says he accompanied Hitler almost everywhere he went. To home in Berchtesgaden, to his forward places, in, like at the Wolf's Lair and so on, his army headquarters, and he lived. And anyway, the final statement is, Hitler was a wonderful boss, and everybody who worked for him, they all say the same thing. All these Germans, they all say the same things about him. He was a wonderful boss. And they called him the chief. And they, you know, everybody enjoyed working for him. He says, We were the closest, he said, I lived with him for 5 years. We were the closest people who worked with him. In the last 8 to 10 days, they were in the underground. I don't need to say all this. His fellow friend there was also an aide, Henschel, ran the lights, air, and water, and he did the telephones, and that's all that was down there. They were down there with in this like an air raid bunker, he called it. Said it was not, there was nothing at all fancy or it's even kind of claustrophobic down there. But on April 22nd, Hitler said, that's it. The war is lost. Everybody can go. I've read that in some other books, too. And then they were all gone almost immediately. It was just the ones who had to stay there to run the place that remained, and he was one of them. You know, he says this. He says that same day that he let everybody go, there was a false report that the Western Allies had called upon Germany to hold Berlin for 2 more weeks against the Soviets so that they could battle communism together. And, of course, this was like a rumor or something. It wasn't true. But Misch says about Hitler, he still believed in a union between West and East, so he got a little hope from that. And he said Hitler liked England, except for Churchill, and didn't think that a people like the English would bind themselves with the communists to crush Germany. Well, that's not a lot of that has come from a lot of people, too. And that seems to be the case. We know Hitler liked England and the English, and he thought they were, you know, the amongst the better race of people. And he couldn't imagine them going along with the Soviet Union and going against Germany. He thought it was Churchill. He thought it was certain of these leaders. He knew it was the Jews there. But he always hoped that somehow, I guess using the word hope sounds kind of silly, but that somehow that, you know, somebody would take over there, you know, some other English people who had better ideas would, you know, move up the ladder and take charge, or that something would happen and things would change. But, you know, he overestimated the English because they didn't. They just went. They were so stuck on the path they were on that they wouldn't change it, and they went all the way to destruction on it. So we think that it was Hitler who went on a destructive course. It really wasn't Hitler. It was these other allies who were on the destructive course. I would argue that. I'm not going to say any more about it because I need to move on here. He talks about, you know, the suicide and the burning of the bodies and that kind of stuff. Pretty much stuff that's already been said. Now, I want to compare this last survivor. I want to compare Misch as being the last loyalist with another German who you might call Hitler's one of the last Hitler disloyalists, and that is a man named Ewald Heinrich von Kleist, who had his obituary in Time magazine on March 13th, 2013. So just last spring, he died, and he was one of the traitors of the July 20th plot. And he was, the thing is that they leave out, they call him von Kleist and Ewald von Kleist, but they leave off the last part of his name because it's von Kleist hyphen Schmensen. Because there is another Ewald von Kleist who was a, who was a famous general and field marshal, served in World War I and under Hitler in World War II with distinction. And they seems to me that they're trying to confuse these two people, and make you think that this, von Kleist, who was, one of Hitler's generals, was against Hitler and was a traitor, because this one who died at age 90 in March was some relative, probably, of the von Kleist family. But his father was not a general. His father was a lawyer. Yeah, but they were wealthy, you know, well known and so on, influential. But his father was a lawyer, and he was anti-Hitler, very anti-Hitler. So Ewald von Kleist, Ewald Heinrich von Kleist Schmenzen, volunteered for a suicide attack on Adolf Hitler. He was the one, and then later he was involved in the Operation Valkyrie, the July 20th plot also. And he was the one who went to I think it was in 19 early in 1944. Okay. But yeah, it doesn't matter. He was the one who put on that, there was going to be a showing of new weapons and new, uniforms and so on. And they wanted to show them to Hitler, and they arranged for this event, you know, at a certain palace. And, this fellow was going to model one of the uniforms, and he put some, those bombs in his pockets. He hid these, those things you pull the thing on and throw. He put some of those in his, in the uniform. He had them hidden in the uniform. And he was wearing it. And his plan was, and other people knew about it. This was a plot that he was going to get up, you know, when he was showing it to Hitler, he was going to get close to Hitler. Then he was going to pull the pin on these, why don't I find this? Cause it's down, it's way down here, I guess. Yeah. I got quite a bit of stuff written here. I'm trying to rush through it as usual. So, but Hitler didn't show up for that thing. He found something else that came up, and so he never showed up. So there was this guy there with these bombs in his uniform that he had to get rid of. But it says here that his father was a lawyer who was an opponent of Nazism. And when Carl Friedrich Gordler in 1942 and 1943, was working on this idea to overthrow Hitler. And, I really can't go into all this because I've got too much else to say. So I'm getting caught up here with a bunch of details. But this man, all right, what I really want to say here, I've got all kinds of information about him, but what I really want to say about him, this Ewald Heinrich von Kleist Schmenzen, but they don't mention, they leave off the Schmenzen, he died in, his father died in 1945. He died just recently. And after, he didn't get, all right, here's the thing. Of all the plotters that were arrested and executed, he was arrested and interrogated, but he was never executed. He was never found guilty. They didn't quite find anything on him. He managed to get away because he wasn't active in it. He was supposed to be, but he was going to do the job that Stauffenberg, carry the briefcase into the map room, into the meeting room. But Stauffenberg decided to do it. So he didn't have to do it. So he really wasn't even there. Anyway, he got away, and afterwards he was sent to the front, to the Eastern Front. He survived that. And, he was an officer, of course, you know, a lieutenant. And, after the war, he became involved in international relations. Well, I'm messing this up, but this is just comparing the kind of person that Misch was and the kind of person that these plotters were, who were anti, Hitler and hated National Socialism. And they are more on the, you find that every time they're like globalists. So he got involved in international relations. This von Kleist. In 1963, he founded what would become the annual Munich Security Conference, bringing together the world's top diplomats for talks on global security policy. So he was a globalist. And, of course, because after 1945, that's where the power was, that's where the money was, that's where the opportunities were. So he went along with that. Plus, he didn't like the National Socialist idea anyway. So for these efforts, he received in 1991 a U.S. Department of Defense's Medal for Distinguished Public Service. Now, he was a German, but he had, I think, gone to the United States. And so here he became a stooge of the Americans. He was no doubt happy when Germany lost the war and the Americans took over. So this is the kind of difference between the people that we have. Now I want to talk about this Rudolf Hauss's daughter. Something just came out recently about her, and I'm going to go to that. I'm going to get rid of this. Oh, no, here it is. All right. I'm going to get rid of this page. I'm going to get rid of this page. All right, that helps. Now, Rudolf Hauss's daughter. Oh, that's a different one. That's just the Daily Mail. There's a picture of her in the Daily Mail article as a young model, where she's quite beautiful. She was a beautiful young woman, and she worked as a model. Well, I'm going to try to get rid of that, and I want to click this on. And I was going to read this, but all right, I think I can do it and still do the maybe I won't read all of it, but I'm going to start reading it and still do the White Rose too, because the White Rose Society has turned out to be very, very interesting. So here, this article. And I'm reading from the Washington Post magazine, where I think it first appeared. And it's written by Thomas Harding. And this Thomas Harding he's been a writer. He's written a couple of books, but not about anything political. Now he's written this book, Hans and Rudolf. And it's a story of his great uncle, Hans Alexander, who was the Jew, the German-American Jew who found Rudolf Hauss and got him and proved who he was and brutalized him and tortured him. I'm not sure if he's the one in the pictures that we see with Hauss. I didn't know that his name was Hans Alexander, but this Thomas Harding says that he was a Jew. So he must be Jew too, because this is his great uncle, which would be the brother of his father or mother. So if he was a full Jew, then Harding must be at least a half Jew. But he discovered this only recently, and then he got interested and started reading all about it, that, you know, this was his great uncle who was the one who did this. And then he heard that Hauss's daughter, one of his daughters, was living in the United States or something. And he tracked her down. So it took him six years. He researched all this and interviewed survivors. And he says in the story that it took him 3 years to find this woman. But he found her. And she had been totally not trying to keep her identity totally hid, you know, totally not known. And but she finally agreed to talk to him under certain conditions. You know. And he seems to be a fairly someone you could, you know, is going to keep his word, has kept his word. And she seems to have gotten used to him and think he's all right. But it says that, you know, she lives in Northern Virginia. She's around 70 years old now or something like that. And she has cancer, and she's dealing with that, so she has a lot of medical stuff to do. And she's all alone, it seems like, now. But she has been in touch with her family. She hasn't spent her life alone. You know, she just doesn't want to involve. She's got grandchildren. But they don't know her story. Even her grandchildren, it says. And maybe not her children either. But she's telling it now because she thinks maybe it should come out. And what they say in the story is that it was Rudolf Höss who designed and built Auschwitz from an old army barracks in Poland to a killing machine capable of murdering 2,000 people an hour. You know, he didn't design and build Auschwitz. I didn't know. That's the dumbest thing I ever saw. Unless there's something I don't know, but I've never seen anything like that before. So I don't think it's possible. He wasn't somebody who designed and built things. But they got it in this article. Anyway, they talk about how all these Jews were murdered at this camp and go through all that kind of thing. You know, the usual stuff. And that he discovered this woman while doing this research for his book. And she said that she would be interviewed only on the condition that neither her married name be revealed nor any details that would disclose her identity. Any details about her. So that people would know, people would say, oh, I know that woman, you know. And she says, there are crazy people out there that burn my house down or shoot somebody in her thick German accent. And if the subject of the Holocaust comes up, she steers the conversation in another direction. And, you know, when she's talking with people, she says, if somebody asks about my dad, I tell them he died in the war. You know, if somebody just says, well, you know, what did your father do or something? She tells him that. Well, it's time for our break, so we'll continue this when we get back. And I hope I will do a better job of the second half. Be right back.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie keinen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and it is September 9th, 2013. This is the Heretics Hour. And I think I have enough time now to do the rest of what I want to do without feeling so rushed, that I always start rushing myself. And so I want to start out because I was talking about the solution, and I was talking quite a bit about Adolf Hitler in the first hour. And so that I don't forget it, I want to read another quote from this person that I quoted something from earlier, who talked about Hitler just being a regular man who was common, who was down to earth and wanted, you know, could relate in a down to earth way with the ordinary people. And he also wrote something that I very much agree with. He said someone on your show once said that all progress for the white race begins with Adolf Hitler, and we must return to him to begin to walk forward again. The only logical and useful work of white nationalism today is spreading the teachings of the Führer, defending his reputation and the reputation of the Reich, exposing the Holocaust and other Jew lies, and spreading anti-Semitism. Everything else is marginal at best. This sounds very extreme, very radical, and probably to most ears, totally unrealistic and not possible and so on. And they could say all the reasons why, but I have to say that, I'm coming more and more to agree with this, with it, simplifying it to such a degree as this. So I'll leave that for now and go back to Bridget Haas. This is the daughter, the older of the two daughters or three daughters of, didn't he have four? They had five children, so they must, but there were two daughters who were kind of similar in age, and she was the oldest. And they're all such good-looking children. And so we're going to hear a little bit more about this family. And she has just turned 80, it says. And she wonders if it's time to tell her grandchildren her story. But she's telling it to this man who promises not to give her married name. And, I'll skip some of the stuff that's not too important. It was a long time ago, she says. I didn't do what was done. I never talk about it. It is something within me. She means she didn't do what. See, she doesn't say it didn't happen. She doesn't say it's a lie. She has to accept it. She grew up in a time when she had no choice, I suppose, but to accept it in a sense. And she just wanted to go away and get away from it all and live her life, you know, and have a life, which is what she did. We'll get to that, I think. It's just her, what she remembers that time is when she was still with her family is within her. It stays with her. she hasn't forgotten it. Now, according to personnel records held in the National Archives in College Park, the author here, Thomas Harding, writes, Inga Bridget Hoss was born on August 18, 1933, on a farm near the Baltic Sea. Her father, Rudolf, and mother, Hedwig, met on this farm, which was a haven for German youths obsessed, he uses the word obsessed, but with ideas of racial purity and rural utopia. So they were kind of idealists who were, you know, German idealists. 1933, that was the year that Hitler came became chancellor. So that was after he was already chancellor. So they were, you know, into the German deal, you know, the German thing about, and probably folkishness, very much into the folkish idea that you, you know, live a pure German life in the countryside and so on. And she is, I thought she was the oldest girl, I thought, but she's the third of five children, three girls and two boys. Well, at least she was older than her one sister. Bridget, she had an extraordinary, they moved from one farm, they moved from the farm to a concentration camps because he was, you know, they put him in charge of these camps, her father in charge of these camps. And they were, he was at Dachau from the time she was age one through five. He was a commandant at Dachau. Then at Sachsenhausen for 2 years when she was five to seven. And from her seventh to 11th year, they were at Auschwitz, which naturally here he calls a death camp. And so supposedly, she, you know, they've got them, you know, living this wonderful life. You know, right next to what all these terrible things that were being done to these prisoners and gassing them and so on. And they knew it. They had to know it, but they didn't care because they were just, you know, living their nice life, you know, as Germans. And they had cooks, nannies, gardeners, chauffeurs, haircutters and cleaners, and some of whom were prisoners. Were naturally, you know, if you're the commandant of a place like that, you are going to have the inmates come and do the housework and the yard work and stuff like that for you. And they would probably be happy to do it because they'd rather do that than something else. So it wasn't like a punishment for these people. They probably had, you know, quite a few benefits from working there. And, you know, it was all very pleasant, around there. They show some pictures of some of the inmates, you know, working around the family there. And they say a lot of junky things, like the family decorated their home with furniture and artwork stolen from prisoners as they were selected for the gas chambers. Is that amazing? Yeah, I don't know what they mean by that. I guess they mean that as soon as they arrived, they were selected for the gas chamber. And so, but they arrived with furniture and artwork and they took it from them. I don't know. You know, the way they write this stuff is just horrible. That's because Jews are doing it. And this writer is a Jew. And they lived a life of luxury, you know. Oh, I told you all that. They just go on about that for a while. And they have some pictures of the kids and looking, you know, playing in their yard and looking happy. They played with each other because they didn't have any other kids, but there are five of them. And so now they say that he's sitting in the den on one side of her house with her, and he starts out asking about the time she spent living next to Auschwitz, I mean in the commandant's house there. It was outside of the Auschwitz, you know, fenced-in area. And she says it's best not to remember all those things. She's more willing to talk about when the British captured her father one cold evening in March 1946. Hans Alexander, this my great uncle, he writes, a German-born Jew, but by then a British captain. Yeah, that's the guy. Banged on the family's door. I remember, now this is Bridget, I remember when they came to our house to ask questions. Her voice is tight. I was sitting on the table with my sister. I was about 13 years old. The British soldiers were screaming, "Where is your father? Where is your father?" to these kids, because he's using the word father. So they're sitting on this table. She's 13, and her sister's a couple years younger, I guess. And they're yelling at him. I got a very bad headache. I went outside and cried under a tree. I made myself calm down. I made myself stop crying, and my headache went away. But I've had migraines for years after that. These migraines stopped a few years ago, but since I received your letter, they have started again. She continues, my older brother Klaus was taken with my mother. He was beaten badly by the British. I've read that elsewhere. My mother heard him scream in pain from the room next door. Just like any mother, she wanted to protect her son, so she told him where my father was. So Alexander assembled a team and headed to the barn at the place where she had said he was, where she was there. She told him the truth. Haas was awakened. He denied he was. She shouldn't have done it. She should have trusted that they wouldn't have really seriously harmed her son. I mean, they might have done something to make him scream. I mean, they had to beat him enough to make him scream. But they wouldn't have, I don't think they would have. But, you know, the mother can't take that. So it's just, and then they were, I believe they were threatening all of her children with sending them. They did. They threatened all of her children that they were going to send them to, turn them over to the Russians. And they would be taken to Siberia and blah, blah. That's what really did it. It wasn't the beating of the son. But they did beat him, in so that she would hear him screaming or crying out and it would affect her. So they say Haas was awakened by them in this barn he was sleeping in. I think he was working as a farmhand somewhere. He denied he was a commandant, certain that he had his man. Alexander demanded to see his wedding ring. Haas claimed it was stuck. He couldn't get it off his finger. But Alexander threatened to cut his finger off until the commandant passed the ring over. Inside was inscribed Rudolph and Hedwig. Oh, yeah. People should not do things like that. At that time, he should have gotten rid of that wedding ring. I don't know why he kept it, but that's what did him in. One thing that did him in. They probably would have known it was him anyway. The commandant was the first person at such a senior level to admit the extent of the slaughter at Auschwitz. Meaning Haas. They got him to admit it. We know what happened to him. They don't go into this here, but we know what they did to him. And he was handed over to the Americans, who made him testify at Nuremberg. Then he was passed to the Poles, who prosecuted him and hanged him. What happened to Hedwig and the children? They scraped by. They were left alone then, and they stole coal from a train to heat their home. They were shoeless. They tied rags around their feet. This is supposed to all be proper retribution for the good life they lived while all those Jews were suffering. And they were shunned because they had been Nazis. And then Klaus, the son, found a job in Stuttgart, and the family's fortunes improved. In the 1950s, Bridget managed to leave Germany and make a new life in Spain. She was a stunning young lady, and go look at that picture on the Daily Mail. You'll see that. She became a model. She had long blonde hair, a slender figure, and a don't mess with me attitude. She worked as a model for 3 years at the Balenciaga fashion house, and she met an Irish-American engineer. They married in 1961. She told him about her father and her life in Auschwitz while they were still dating. And he was a little shocked, he says, at first, but then he liked her. So he said, it wasn't her fault. She was a victim too, and she was just a child, and so they just wouldn't talk about it, and he put it aside. And they had a daughter and a son, so okay, she has a daughter and a son with this husband. But they broke up later, and this man was married twice after that. I don't think she did. I don't know. Doesn't say that. I guess she doesn't want him to talk about who she's with now or what's going on there. In 1972, though, she and this man moved to Washington and to the United States. And they bought a house in Georgetown. She struggled. This is not too interesting. You know, she didn't know how to do anything. She didn't know how to write a check, use a checkbook, or she spoke little English and so on. But she got a part-time job in a fashion boutique because she was so fashionable, and probably her foreign accent was a plus. So then a Jewish lady, visited and asked her to come to work in her fashion salon in the district. So she moved up to a better fashion salon, but it was owned by Jews, and they liked her, and she was she got drunk with her manager one time and confessed that her father was Rudolf Haas, and the manager told the store's owner, but these owners liked her and wanted to keep her, and they said the same thing as her husband, that she didn't, you know, it wasn't her fault, and they weren't going to hold it against her. So they kept it quiet, and she remained working at that store for 35 years and served prominent Washingtonians, including the wives of senators and congressmen. So just like the Nazis, you know, these people live a privileged life in Washington, these prominent government people, and they're served by people like Bridget, you know, in their stores and so on where they go, and they have plenty of money to have all kinds of help. And there's no difference in, you know, it's the same everywhere. So she retired a few years ago, and let's go on to the next page. And they're wondering why they didn't hate her and blame her and shun her and so on and so forth, but they didn't. And now she's moved to a small house. No, that's Hedwig. Hedwig visited. Okay, starting in the 1960s, Bridget's mother, Hedwig, visited every few years from Germany, and she had moved to a small house in Stuttgart, where she lived with one of her daughters. She was not granted a state pension, nor did she receive any other income from the government, like other widows of German soldiers. Of course, the Third Reich German soldiers weren't given anything. They weren't considered. Some of the soldiers did get their pensions, but not if you're in the top, among the top people, I guess. So Hedwig had to appear as a witness at the Frankfurt Auschwitz trial in 1965. But otherwise, there were no travel restrictions on her. And she could travel around as she wanted, and so she went to Washington to stay with her daughter, Bridget, often. And her last visit was in September 1989, when she was 81 and frail, and she died there. She felt tired one evening, and while she was at her daughter's, and the next day they found her dead in her sleep. So, Bridget had her cremated there, and they buried her there in a cemetery there. Is there anything? It's got to be something more important here, because I know there's something at the end I like. All right, here we go. Bridget's son lives with her. He knows about his grandfather, but has not expressed any interest in looking further into the history. She's visited often by her grandchildren, but her daughter has died. Her daughter died, it says. But she flies, once a year she flies to Florida to spend time with her sister, Anna Gret, who flies in from Germany. So Anna Gret flies to Florida once a year, and Bridget flies down there and they visit, you know, they spend time together there. Their brother Klaus died in the 1980s. The other two, Hans Jürgen and the elder sister Heide Traud, so she's not the oldest sister, both live in Germany. None of them talk about their childhood, I guess, even when they're together. They just don't go back to that. Too hard. Okay, now Bridget has a nephew, son of her brother, and he has made friends with this Harding guy and traveled with him to Auschwitz in 2009. And he's the one who, when at some point when they were at Auschwitz, turned to him, this Bridget's nephew, and he said, "If I knew where my grandfather was buried, I would piss on his grave." So this is what they do. Oh, this is what they've done to the children of these Nazis. You know, they've turned them against their parents and alienated them in ways that are unnatural and wrong, but they think, you know, it's perfectly proper to do so. But Bridget is wondering. She has more loyalty to her father. She just doesn't want to get involved with other Germans who will talk about it or talk about Germany or any of those things. She keeps away from it. She doesn't want to, she's never talked about her father to her grandchildren. But her ex-husband says he's given Haas's autobiography to the older two. Can you imagine? So they know. So they've been given the propaganda, that book that Haas wrote under duress, but they don't ask their grandmother about him. And she, she says she doesn't want to upset them, her grandchildren, and she's worried that they might tell people, which could put the family at risk. She says she's still scared here in Washington because there are a lot of Jewish people and they still hate the Germans. It never ends. I thought that was pretty interesting. She's a careful woman. She's careful about what she says, but she said this to him. A lot of Jewish people, she realizes, they still hate the Germans and it never ends. Like the Holocaust propaganda, you know, they don't want that to end, so they don't want the hatred of Germans to end either. She said she's thinking about sharing her story with her family, and maybe when she reads his book, the book that I already mentioned, she might do so. She seems to have gotten friendly with this guy because she's talked to him and he's writing this book. It's kind of too bad, that she can't get to the whole truth. But she does say they always make things worse than it is. It is so awful, I can't stand it. She says she understands the value of museums to remind us of the horrors of the past, so she's, you know, accepting that. But she says it should be in Auschwitz or in Israel, not in Washington. At least that's good. And she says they always make things worse than it is, that is, you know, in the museum. And she can't stand to go there because it's so awful, you know. But she does sense that it wasn't as bad as what they say. And she says she does not, he writes, she does not deny that atrocities took place or that Jews and others were murdered in the camps, but she questions that millions were killed. How can there be so many survivors if so many had been killed, she asks. I wish more people would come out with those questions and admit that they have them. But you should see some of the comments to these articles are pretty nasty. So, you know, if she reads them, she probably doesn't read them, but if she would read them, she'd be afraid to say anything again. He says that he pointed out to her that her father confessed to being responsible for the death of more than a million Jews. You know, in that book, you know, he confesses to that. And she says the British took it out of him with torture. So she knows that part. And he says, "And your father, how do you remember him?" he asks her. And she answers, "He was the nicest man in the world. He was very good to us." She remembers them eating together, playing in the garden, and reading the story of Hansel and Gretel. She is convinced that her father was a sensitive man and had guessed that he was involved with something bad. "I'm sure he was sad inside," she recalls. "It is just a feeling. The way he was at home, the way he was with us, Sometimes he looked sad when he came back from work. So she thinks then he has a dual nature. There must have been two sides of him. The one that I knew and then another. So see, she's trying to accept these lies, and it's hard, since he wrote that book, you know, it's hard to not to believe it. But she knows him. She knew him. And when you see pictures of Rudolf Hess, before he was arrested and all that, before 1945, he looks like such a good man. He looks like such a decent man. And he did a lot of good things as camp commandant. And there were, a lot of the prisoners liked him. I mean, he talked with them and so on. He got himself, it's just awful. Just keep saying that. But, you know, that the way they have twisted everything around, and you can't just get the truth out, because this other stuff is everywhere. This is what we have to do something about. We really do. And she says she thinks he had to do what he did. He was made to do it somehow. And she thinks maybe the Nazis threatened his family, that they were threatened if he didn't do what they wanted him to do. That's just nonsense. And he was one of many in the SS. There are others as well who would do it if he didn't. So she's trying to justify and figure it all out, because she knows in her senses that her father wouldn't be a person to do those kind of things. Well, certainly wouldn't take any pleasure or do it coldly. And so she's just trying to figure it all out. She actually has the photograph of her mother and father above her bed in her bedroom, their wedding photograph. That's how much she feels for them. How many people have their mother's father's wedding photograph above their bed? But she does. And it was in 1929. They look young, happy, and carefree. So she sleeps every night under their picture. And they have here a large picture in the Washington Post article of this man's great uncle, Hans Alexander, the German Jew who tracked down and caught the commandant. Now, he's the evil one, but he's here looking kind of good looking with a pipe in his mouth. Let's see if there's anything more important here. Wait a minute. Oh, this is, he's just talking to her former employers. All right. So that's what we know now about, Bridget Hess. And, I'm going to turn now to, get past this. You know, another thing I want to say is that another family that remained loyal and loved their husband and father were the Himmlers. And both Margaret Himmler, his wife, and Hedwig, his mistress, remained loyal to Himmler. And both were saying good things about him in 1945. They were so happy for him that he was doing such important work, and that Germany looked to him for so much and so on. They were very supportive, and Margaret and Gudrun Himmler, similar to the they themselves were arrested because they had fled to Italy, and they were arrested by American troops in Italy, and they were held in various internment camps in Italy, France, and Germany. And they were, because they probably didn't cooperate as well, they probably weren't cooperating. And they were brought to Nuremberg to testify at the trials, and they weren't released until November 1946. And Gudrun emerged from the experience embittered by her alleged mistreatment and has remained devoted to her father's memory. So she says that she was mistreated by the Americans. I would like to read about that. I would like to know more about that, how they treated those two. They both survived, but and there's there was a picture there of the two of them in American custody, looking all right. Now, the White Rose Society. Wow, I'm probably going to have to talk about this more another time, too, because getting into this, I've never really read beyond the superficial stuff about it. But I was doing so today, and it's really interesting. I hope I can cover all this. Maybe I can, or what I have, anyway. Because I think it also that it fits into the theme of who's a loyalist, who's a traitor, and, you know, who are the good people, who are the bad people. And it's all been, of course, shifted exactly opposite, or you could say turned inside out or turned 180 degrees or whatever, but it's the exact opposite of what it should be. And the White Rose Society is portrayed as these wonderful youthful martyrs who tried to do the right thing and were against Hitler, like so all good people should have been, and except the brain, if they were the brainwashed ones, and they did all this brave resistance work, and they were executed by the National Socialists, by the government, by Hitler, so to speak, and they were only young people in their early 20s. So in reading about it, I decided to go with this Jürgen Wittgenstein memoir, which at first I thought, well, this is probably God knows what he's writing it. But, well, yeah, he was one of them, but it's pretty informative. And I think he's a pretty good fellow. Actually, he was the son of Oscar Jürgen Wittgenstein, who was, killed in World War I before Jürgen was born. Jürgen's father died in the war before he was even born, I think, or right about that time anyway. And his mother was Elisabeth Bollmöller Wittgenstein. And he was brought up by her. Let's see. Who's in my place now? Golly. So from 1931 to 1937, this Wittgenstein attended boarding school at Lake Constance. And the now here's the first sign of a Jew entering the picture. The director of his boarding school was the first German Jewish educator, Kurt Hahn, who was arrested in 1933 by the Nazis. And consequence of that, he emigrated to Scotland. So he wasn't killed or anything. He was able to leave the country. But Hahn had exerted a strong influence on Wittgenstein. So if he was arrested in 33, he had been anti-Nazi for some time. And when Hitler came into power, he was one of the ones, that Jews, that they rounded up and arrested. And all of these Jews that they arrested early on, they put him in camps here and there, and then they encouraged them to emigrate. They encouraged them to leave the country, and a whole lot of them did. And he was one, and he had a big influence on this Jürgen Wittgenstein, who was one of the group of the White Rose Society. And Wittgenstein graduated in 1937 from school, and he performed the six-month Reich labor service and then the two-year military service. Everybody had all males had a two-year military service after their six-month Reich labor service. Well, that was that was during wartime. No, it was 37, and then not quite. So they had this military service to serve, and then you were free to do what you wanted to do, I guess. And Wittgenstein applied in 1939, December, to join the Nazi Party. And he had a number, and he was blah, blah. But then he later became a member of this resistance group. And he was, it was through Alexander Schmorell. And this Alexander Schmorell was the one who kind of started it with Hans Scholl, the German boy. They were all medical students at this Wittgenstein was a medical student too. They were all medical students at the University of Munich. And Morell is real interesting because he is one of the he is probably the number one person that the group formed around. Because he actually emigrated to the United States after the war, and too. Let me go to the next thing. Now, Wittgenstein writes about the group, and he says they all came from bourgeois families, and their parents were opposed to Hitler, which probably influenced them. He was not one of the deepest principals, but he was associated with it. He was friends with them, and he probably helped out quite a bit, but he wasn't one of the main principals. So he's able to be a little bit objective, it seems. And he says that, so right off the bat, they came from homes that were opposed to Hitler. And they were medical students, except for Sophie, who was the sister of Hans Scholl, who was a biology student. But it says they shared a common interest in and a deep love for the arts, music, literature, and philosophy. So they were not so political in the beginning. They were all into loving the arts and music and literature, and they formed groups about this. But, you know, what I'm saying is they didn't have a deep love maybe for Germany, not the kind that the National Socialists had anyway. They had a different idea of what Germany should be. And Jurgen says most of us had Jewish friends or classmates who were evicted or deported and or who had suffered during the Kristallnacht pogrom. And they were all very friendly to Jews and didn't, you know, were totally against the anti-Jewish policy of the National Socialists. So he says it all began in the winter of 1938-39. So that means if these kids were all about 20 years old then or so, they were born in 1918-19, or if they were 22 years old, they were, you know, born a couple of years earlier than that. But they grew up in the Weimar period, and they didn't seem to have suffered too much during the Weimar period because they came from families who were opposed to Hitler, meaning that they were satisfied with the status quo. You know, they served their two-year army service before they could enter medical school. And then he says, this is where I met Alexander Schmorell. He was a multi-talented, gifted sculptor, deeply interested in literature and music. He was born in Russia to a German father, a physician, and a Russian mother. So you see, he was half Russian, this Schmorell. We soon discovered our similar political, and we became close friends. He says in the, they were, you know, in this, in their 2 year military training thing before they could go into medical school. And he said in the barracks, or this was after they were in medical school and then they had to go and do some, and in the summer to the front and, help out medically there. Become as medical assistants and so on. I'm not real clear when this was said, but he says in the barracks, Schmorell one time pointed to the door of our room and said, maybe 10 years from now, there will be a plaque on this door, which will read, this is where the revolution began. Well, I think this is after they had started their White Rose Society, and we'll find out if we have time here what, you know, when they're in these barracks. It was a little while later. But see, he's seen it as a revolution, this Schmorell. He's a revolutionary. And there he is, you know, Russian. The Russians are just natural revolutionaries, huh? And I don't know that he wasn't Jewish, doesn't say anything about him being Jewish. But I think, you know, I get the feeling that this White Rose Society, all these young people were influenced by pro-communist and Jewish ideas. I think very much so. They at least went that direction rather than the right wing direction, very, very easily. I mean, naturally they did. So they were naturally more communist sympathizers and likers of Jews than they were likers of the folkish idea. And so let's see. So he introduced Alex Schmorell to Hans Scholl. He introduced those two guys to each other. They were other medical students. And he said Hans Scholl was Lutheran, but he was influenced by a couple of Catholic men. But he was a devout Lutheran. And he even considered converting to Catholicism for a while. At that time, he and his friends initiated Lesia Bende, where they read relevant modern and classical literature to each other, which they then discussed until late into the night. And so they were real intellectuals, and they really liked to meet together and talk about these, in this case, literature, and discuss it late into the night. And concurrently, this Jürgen started his own circle, and he says, we invited well-known writers, playwrights, performers, poets, and musicians to share their work with us and where we read our own poetry to their critique. In both groups, the discussions never touched on politics. Rather, they were centered on our consuming interest in all aspects of art, music, and philosophy. All of us frequently attended concerts and important plays. So you have here a group of arty-like intellectuals, which I'm very familiar with when I was young and in school. And they weren't so political, but they were very different from what the party, National Socialist Party people, would have been, which was more of the common, you know, helping the common people and the common German folk and so on. And they were more, you know, they're more into this other stuff. And this is what they loved. And but they were able to attend concerts in important places, even in 1940, 1941 is the time we're talking about here. And all this, as Wilhelm Mann said, all this stuff was going on in Germany, that culture continued because Hitler wanted it to. And nobody was interfering with these people, you know, doing the things they wanted to do. And they didn't have to join the party or anything like that. But as their personal friendships grew, they developed a political conviction against Hitler and the Nazi regime, he says. And then when the deportations of Jews began and the remaining ones were forced to wear the Yellow Star of David, well, they didn't like that. And then he says that they heard about German atrocities in occupied Poland and Russia, that these became known. Now, I don't know who they became known through, because there was these rumors by Jews, you see, and communists were spreading these rumors, and Jews, not Germans, were not doing that. So I have, again, you have to wonder where they're getting their information from and who they're linked up with. But, you know, it seems as though the Gestapo never found any links of theirs to communist groups or to Soviet Union or anything like that. So my little thinking that they might, you know, through this Schmorell guy, maybe he had, you know, been approached to be an agent by the Soviet Union, by the Soviet government, and he was, you know, setting this up here, you know, in Germany. But the Gestapo would have found some of this, you'd think. I mean, they were pretty darn good. But they never published anything like that, so probably there wasn't. I mean, I have to go by that. But they also they were copies of Bishop Galen's sermon condemning the killing of inmates in insane asylums. You know, that did go on for a while. It was the killing of inmates, but it was the program of euthanasia for the hopelessly insane and terribly retarded and so on people. More than retarded, I mean, really absolutely incapable functioning people. Anyway, you know, Bishop Galen came out about that. So they were, that was being circulated in secret, and they were influenced by that. And they had got the conviction that something had to be done. Now, really, I wonder how this group of young medical students could get this idea that they needed to do something. I find it kind of far-fetched, and to go as far as they went. So again, I kind of think about this Alex Schmorell as being the ringleader and pushing it along, but Hans Scholl was right there with him. And they had to just be so idealistic. And they wrote four leaflets in the summer of 1942. They copied them on a typewriter and made as many copies as they could. See, no computer, no copiers or anything at that time. Probably they didn't have more than 100 to start with, and they distributed them throughout Germany. And at this time, it was just Alex Schmorell, Hans, and Hans Scholl, and maybe this Jürgen was helping them a little bit. And they said Hans wrote two of them, and Alex Schmorell helped with two of them. I don't know, Hans. And he wrote the others. So Hans was the main writer, but Alex wrote too, and distributed them. And they put them in telephone books, phone books, booths, mailed them to professors and students, and sent them to other universities for distribution. You know, and all four were written in a relatively brief period between June 27th and July 12th. Yeah, that is just a few weeks' time. They wrote these, four of them, and this was in 1942. Now, they also sent the leaflets to other members of the White Rose. So they had members, but they weren't as active. They seemed to have these, you know, there were quite a number of other students, not that many, maybe 10 or, you know, something, who supported them, must have helped out, but they weren't. They weren't doing the actual writing or, you know, taking the main chances. And they sent them to them to see if, to check whether they would be intercepted. But they weren't intercepted. But of the first 100 leaflets that were put out, 35 were turned over to the Gestapo. So 35 people came upon these leaflets and decided that this was not good and this was treason, and they're going to turn them over to the Gestapo. So now the Gestapo knew about it, and but they didn't know who was responsible, because they were very good at keeping it all, you know, secretive. And then Sophie joined. She entered the university and she joined. And it says here, and I'm going to read the first leaflet. I hope I have time. It says here that all four leaflets carried the same message. They mentioned the mass extermination of Jews and Polish nobility. That means they were talking about Katyn or Katyn, the Katyn massacre. And that was the Russian propaganda being put out, that the Germans had murdered this Polish nobility. But it was the Russians who did it. So there's another clue that there's something Soviet behind what these young people were doing, seems to me. And it's Jürgen says they were suffused with idealism, almost ecstatic enthusiasm, were laced with quotations. He's talking about the leaflets by Goethe, Schiller, Laozi, Novalis, Aristotle, and others. It's just like, you know, young students would do, who are, you know, learning about all this stuff. And, you know, when you're young, you think you know everything. And here's a quote from the fourth. I'm going to go on down here and see if I can read some of this. I'm going to run out of time. The first leaflet starts out like this. Nothing is so unworthy of a civilized nation as allowing itself to be governed without opposition by an irresponsible clique that has yielded to base instinct. It is certain that today every honest German is ashamed of his government. Who among us has any conception of the dimensions of shame that will befall us and our children when one day the veil has fallen from our eyes and those horrible of crimes, crimes that infinitely outdistance every human measure, reach the light of day. Well, they go on and get worse and worse. Another sentence I'll just read from this first leaflet says, by means of gradual, treacherous, systematic abuse, the system has put every man into a spiritual prison. Only now, finding himself lying in fetters, has he become aware of his fate. And then a little bit later they say, it says, therefore, every individual conscious of his responsibility as a member of Christian and Western civilization must defend himself as best he can at this late hour. He must work against the scourges of mankind, against fascism and any similar totalitarianism. Well, fascism was what the Soviets called what the Nazis were doing. They called National Socialism and the Third Reich fascist. So these leaflets are also calling it fascist and using fascist as a bad term. And they say that they refer to Hitler as a subhuman, that people are following, giving up their blood on the battlefield for the hubris of a subhuman. So, and then they get worse after that. So as they go on, they start attacking the government and the Hitler and the National Socialist Party and so on as having to be brought down. They want to bring it down. So they're really writing seriously traitorous material. And so you have to understand that this was a problem for the government. The government couldn't just allow them to continue doing that. They had to stop it. And by the time they did, they had said so many terrible things that they were guilty of treason and had to be executed. Let me find out where I was before. Now, okay, I'm going to read this. At the to forestall any suspicion that the White Rose was somehow financed by Germany's enemies, the Allies, instead of being a purely German movement, the fourth leaflet states, we emphatically point out that the White Rose is not in the pay of any foreign power, although we know that the National Socialist power must be broken by military means. See, now, they're saying right there that they want Germany to lose the war militarily because their power can only be broken by military means. That means the Allies. So this makes them out-and-out traitors. And they go on and say, an example must be set after the war so that no one will ever have the slightest desire to try anything like this ever again. Now, that is definitely the way the Jewish Allied post-war talk was. You know, we're going to make an example. And they even talked like this before the end. We've got to make an example of Germany so that never again will anybody have the slightest desire to do anything like this. Or they'll never, you know, the Germans will never want to do anything like this again. And they say, then they even say, do not forget the minor scoundrels of this system. Note, they're telling the German people this in these leaflets. Note their names so that no one may escape. That's again like what the Americans and the Allies did after the war, trying to get every last person. Don't let anybody escape. In fact, we're still doing that. We're still going Nazi hunters. This is the Nazi hunter. So these kids are sounding worse and worse, you know, like real hunters of the people that they don't like. We shall not be silent. We are your bad conscience. The White Rose will not leave you in peace. So, you know, this was serious stuff they were putting out. And Christopher Probst then joined, and then Willie Graf. And they say that Alex Schmorell, who spoke Russian fluently from his few years in Russia, because his family moved to Germany when he was only 4 years old. But he still had a Russian nanny who was a mother. His mother died young, so she was like a mother to him, and so he probably spoke Russian with her. And when they were on the front as medical students, you know, they had to go to the front for the summer, he was able to talk to the Russians, and Hans Scholl gave his entire tobacco ration, an extremely valuable commodity, to a Jew in a forced labor column. We felt a profound compassion for an outrage on behalf of those suffering. And anyway, they did 6 leaflets, and they were working on the 7th when they were arrested because Hans and Sophie had gone to drop leaflets in a university, and they were seen by a janitor, and the janitor apprehended them and called the police, which is the Gestapo, just the police. And they took them into custody, and then they found, you know, they had all that evidence on them, and they found a few other people, and they had some evidence on them. So eventually there was a trial. The first trial was the two Scholls and Christopher Probst, and they were all sentenced to death, and they were executed that same day. And then the second trial took place in April. This is in 1944, and Schmorell, Graf, and Huber was a professor that was helping them, I didn't get a chance to talk about him, were sentenced to death, but others were sentenced to forced labor. And these three were eventually executed, but not immediately. It took over a year before they executed Schmorell and Huber, and Willy Graf took 1.5 years. But they weren't mistreated. It didn't seem like they, but they were executed. Now, I've got only 60 seconds left, so I just managed to get through this. I wanted to kind of compare this to the men, the plotters, the conspirators of the July 20th plot, and that these men were all hoping. They all caused a lot of more deaths of German soldiers, and they caused the Germans to lose battles, and these young people in the White Rose Society also wanted to destroy the war effort and cause the Germans to lose, and they were all on the side of the international group. They were on the side of the Allies. They would have turned into globalists. They're basically globalists. So we have to see the sides clearly, and I've run out of time to be able to describe that. So I will have to pick this up at another time to make some, you know, good points about it. And so this is the end of the show, ladies and gentlemen, and good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.